Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Authors Access, where authors get published and published authors get successful. Hi, I'm Irene Watson, and I'm the managing editor of Reader Views in Austin, Texas. Our show is recorded live every Thursday at 8 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. Today's topic is Understanding the Publishing Marketplace, and our special guest who will be joining us this hour is Victor Volkman of Loving Healing Press. You can learn more about our guest on Authors Access website, which is authorsaccess.com. I'm just really delighted to be talking to Victor Volkman, owner of Loving Healing Press, and he's stationed in Ann Arbor, Michigan. He's also my co-host on Authors Access, and today I have the opportunity to actually interview him. Victor began his writing career freelancing for publications such as C++, User's Journal, and Windows Developer's Journal for about 15 years. But in the mid-1990s, he published two computer programming books with a Fortune 500 publisher. Victor became discouraged by the lack of marketing support and low sales, and so he was determined to never write again. Don't we know that? However, a decade later, Victor launched his own self-published book to help promote the work of the Traumatic Incident Reduction Association, a nonprofit organization dedicated to teaching psychologists and social workers brief and effective techniques for dealing with post-traumatic stress. Obviously, this is just total opposite than what he was doing before. Victor quickly discovered that there were many other authors who had helpful and effective techniques to share, but could not get the time of day from other publishers or agents. So, Loving Healing Press was born in September 2003. And as of today, the company has 24 titles in print and another six on the way before 2007 is finished. That's pretty impressive in such a short time. Victor is very dedicated to the publishing industry, and I'm really happy to have him share his knowledge with us. I've known him for a while, and he's just somebody that you can really go to and ask information, and he has it right there. So this is going to be a really great talk tonight. And it seems out there that there are so many different types of opportunities on how to share, or pardon me, how to have your book published, and because of the variety, it gets really confusing. So I've asked Victor to give us clarity on the differences so that we have a deeper understanding on the direction that best suits us. So, Victor, welcome. I'm delighted to be talking to you.
Well, good evening, Irene, and thanks for the warm introduction. It sounds so much better when you're saying it.
Well, I mean it. I really do. We all want to get a traditional publisher. Here we go into one of these big stores, Barnes & Noble or wherever, and we've got this pie in the sky, and we see our book there because we've written this book that's going to be the bestseller. We're going to sell a million copies, and we're going to have it in every bookstore in the nation and even foreign. So obviously that means we have to go with a traditional publisher. Give us some ins and outs on traditional publishing.
Right. There are several key attributes that you really need to be able to recognize to establish that you're working with a traditional publisher. I mean, obviously there's the big four or five, Houghton Mifflin and Doubleday and so on, but actually there are a lot of other publishers out there, and it's nice to know who am I dealing with. So one of the things you can recognize as being a traditional publisher is they will handle your cover design completely, and they will work out the interior layout of your book. They will print and ship galleys, which are pre-publication editions. I know we've talked a little bit about that in previous shows. They will also list your titles with distributors or wholesalers, and they will also arrange for the books to be printed, and they will develop a basic one-page sell sheet and perhaps some additional collateral to go with your book, for example, bookmarks, postcards, and posters that might be used as promotional items, and they'll also handle the basics of book signings, which is to say that, you know, if you contact your local bookstore, that your publisher will darn well make sure that there's some books there when you show up. Now, that's just some of the things that everyone should expect in a traditional publisher. And there's a few optional other things that they may do, but in my experience are somewhat rare, and consider yourself blessed if you find this. They may also pay for advertising for your book in trade journals. They may pay to develop and distribute press releases or email campaigns. They may have services of a publicist who will assist you in booking you with appropriate radio and TV hosts. They may provide marketing coaching, and they may even provide significant proofing beyond the simple copy editing. I know we've all bought books that were on some other seller list that had grammatical errors, and believe me, there's a lot less copy editing going on than there used to be. So that's the basics of what they will do and they won't do. And now I'd like to talk a little bit about authors sort of expect are going to happen after they hand in the manuscript. And that can be lead to a big sort of reality shock if you're not ready for this. So the bigger the publisher that you're going to work with, the more likely that you'll need an agent. And that's sort of proportional. The bigger the publisher, the less likely they are to seriously consider unsolicited manuscripts. In fact, you know, you may need to contact 25 or more publishers to get published. There's some famous cases like, I think it is Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Mechanics that took 125 submissions before he got published. And another thing that you want to look to is publishers that are already in your genre. Every publisher isn't appropriate for every book. Some specialize in mysteries, some in romances, and they have various product lines. So you want to make sure that you're addressing the publisher that is actually going to be able to work with your property. Now, the average industry payout that you'll run into is about 10% of list price. Some publishers will tell you that you're going to get 20%, but that's usually 20% of a wholesale price, which is the price that they sell to the next lowest person in the distribution chain. So your 20% of wholesale actually comes out to be about 10%. And so you have to wonder why they're throwing this big number at you. Another thing to know is that you shouldn't expect to retire after sending in your first book unless you're willing to spend 8 hours a day on marketing. It really is a lot to get things noticed in a market that produces 195,000 new titles every year, as we found out from last year's sales figures. And the other thing that you'll need to know is that publishers are really interested in pre-publication and the first 90 days. After about 90 days, the publishers kind of lost interest in your book because they have a lot more books to get out, and it's sort of sink or swim in that critical period. What it turns out is if you don't have a realistic marketing plan for those critical 90 days, you may find that you're working a lot harder to gain momentum later. First print runs are usually quite small, often as low as 2,000 copies. Just as we find that movies are opening at smaller number of screens every week due to the sheer number of films, books face a similar hurdle, especially considering the number of titles each year is growing by about 20,000 new titles. So probably this year we're going to break 200,000 and some change in new titles. And the other thing to know is that industry return rates are now approaching 30% for bookstores. So a book isn't actually sold until it leaves the store because, you know, bookstores actually don't buy books. This may come as a shock to some people, but it's an entirely consignment operation. So if they don't sell your book, it's no skin off their nose. They'll just send it back and get 100% credit for it. So those are some of the basic ins and outs for traditional publishing.
Victor, I had heard you say that the traditional publisher may do this, they may do that. There was a lot of may.
Yeah.
And I would like to just take that a little further. Why all the may?
Well, that's a good question. Marketing budgets vary considerably, and so do the resources. And a lot of it may depend on, frankly, maybe how big of a print run they're going to put into a book is going to be proportional to how much resources that they're willing to outlay. I mean, that's part of it. It just depends, I guess, is the short answer.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So basically what I'm hearing you also say, that just because you go with a traditional publisher, it doesn't mean that you can sit back and roll in the dough kind of thing. You still have to have the marketing plan. You still have to do your own marketing.
Exactly. I can only describe the horror when I got my quarterly sales report, or the first quarter, and, you know, it would show that maybe 200 copies were sold, and then the next quarter, 150 went back to the warehouse. There's nothing worse than seeing a negative number on your sales report. It'll ruin your whole day.
Well, no kidding. All that excitement that actually 200 were out, and then in reality, you only sold 50.
Yeah.
Yeah, well.
Just hypothetically. Yeah.
Right, right. So also you had mentioned that the shelf life is only about 90 days. So that's pretty limiting, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, the bookstores may hold a book for 3 or 4 months, but if it doesn't start moving, the problem is there's only so many shelf feet in the bookstore. And I read the figure, I believe, from Dan Pointer that said 30 new shelf feet of books are produced every week, I believe it is. So, like, every week they need to, you know, take down 30 shelf feet of books and put in 30 shelf feet more of new books.
Wow, so there has to be real turnover there. And so basically, if you don't do your own publicity and get this book going, regardless if you're with a traditional publisher or, which we're going to talk to later about later, self-publishing, you still have to do that work to keep the book on the shelf and
right.
in the
and
people's
we've
hands.
Been seeing from the latest industry report that the bookstore sales are now, I believe, at 43% of the worldwide market and falling. So they're becoming a less significant market share as time goes on. And frankly, I haven't seen, you know, some of the major chains' annual reports, but I suspect they're making more on coffee than book sales.
Well, you know, and that's maybe a good point that we should really look at as to why are the coffee shops going in. And like you say, they're probably making more money because if the returns are that huge, there's got to be some type of a balance. So before we go on to any, these others, do you have anything else that you can add to traditional publishing?
I think that kind of wraps up some of the basic points.
Mm-hmm.
The thing to remember is, as an author, when you turn in that manuscript, it's really just the beginning and not the end.
Right.
The beginning of your adventure of how am I going to have this thing make a difference in the world.
And, you know, some authors, writers think that writing the book was the hardest part. It really isn't. It really isn't.
I haven't gotten there yet.
That's right, exactly. So now we just talked about traditional publishing. There's also the term of independent publisher. Is there a difference between independent publishing and traditional publishing?
Actually, independent publishing publisher is just considered usually a smaller version of the same thing. I was looking today at the Publishers Marketing Association website. I believe it's pma-online.org. And that's a great resource for people to learn about what they're about to get into. And I've got a definition which is it's just pretty specific and it's also pretty vague. I'll just read it. They say that an independent publisher is a publisher who publishes the books of others and pays royalties. Independent publishers may or may not also publish their own books. They may use either offset or digital printing techniques. So it can be the case that a lot of us out here are authors/publishers. So we have an independent press, and we publish some of our own books and some of other people's books, and we pay royalties. That's really it in a nutshell.
Okay. Well, that makes sense. What about mainstream publisher?
That is basically a code word for traditional publishing, and it's something that you'll see when people are saying that they've tried self-publishing and they want to get out of it. So they're saying, next time around, you know, this is too much work, I'll go for a mainstream publisher. So there isn't really any technical or marketing definition there. It's just sort of industry slang.
Well, that makes sense. Now, there's also, I've heard of normal publisher. And normal, you know, what is that? Probably right now it would be the traditional publisher, and who knows, in 10 years from now it could be self-publisher would be the normal.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Those two I hear bandied about, mainstream publisher, normal publisher. They're just people trying to express something as being different from either self-publishing or subsidy publishing.
So, okay, you mentioned subsidy. Let's go right into that. What is
sure.
subsidy publishing? Now, I've heard of a subsidy publisher, and I've also heard of a subsidy press. Is there a difference?
No. When someone says the press publisher and books, if you see that in a company name, they're all pretty much synonymous. So that part you don't have to worry about. Subsidy press, again, going back to the Publishers Marketing Association, so is a publisher who publishes the books of others for a fee and or with an agreement that the author will purchase a certain number of books. So You may be paying a cost up front, which varies between about $200 to $1,000 up front, or there may be an agreement that, well, you don't pay up front, but you have to buy 50 copies, or a mixture of the two. You may pay a little money and buy fewer copies, et cetera, et cetera. Now, the fee paid by the author may cover some or all of the production and printing costs, although some subsidy publishers have very high standards of manuscript preparation, design, production, and so on. Other subsidy publishers don't. They'll basically send them a Word file, and they say, well, you know, it's got alphabetic letters and spaces in it. It must be a book, and they print it out pretty much as is. And some of them will also sell you editing packages. So you may say, you know, the book maybe costs $400 to get in their system, but they want to sell you, you know, $500 worth of editing, and it may actually need it. I don't know. So there often you'll see a full suite of services where you can just buy more and more and more add-ons to achieve whatever it is you're trying to get out of it. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, I got it. So you basically there's a minimum package where you pay the subsidy press or publisher to publish your book, and then there's all these add-ons, and also possibly that you have to buy so many copies of your book.
Right, and the implication may or may not be there that if you didn't buy, you know, the $2,000 marketing package, well, and your book didn't sell, well, maybe that's why. But, you know, you can't really tell whether the extra marketing package would have been the thing that made it a success. Now, there's a couple other points about subsidy that I want to make sure are clear, and that's the best description I've run into is that subsidy presses make their money from authors, whereas traditional presses make their money from the book-buying public. So that's their revenue model. You know, as the author, that's where their money's coming from.
So what would be a disadvantage of going with a subsidy press for an author?
Certain subsidy presses, I suppose, have a reputation in the industry as being, you know, book mills, and it may discourage reviewers. I don't really know enough about the review business to say that if, you know, XYZ publisher has their name attached to a book that you'll refuse to look at it. That's a question maybe that you could answer, but the big disadvantage is that you'll find the cost per unit is a little bit higher such that you can't really sell them in bookstores because the typical bookstore is going to be ordering from a wholesaler who wants 55% off list price. So if your book actually costs, say, $10 from the subsidy press, which is not, you know, an unrealistic number if you divide out what you paid for it, the setup costs, you know, amortized over plus the individual price per copy, it could certainly be $10 a piece, then you will have to have a list price of $22 just to break even. And that's pretty steep. So because of the fact that you have to set your list price higher, there's fewer opportunities to work with wholesalers, and if you do, there's very little money in it. But for certain people, that's okay. Like if you are someone on the lecture circuit and you lecture about a specific topic and you sell books in the back of the room and people are paying, you know, whatever you say, maybe you have you set your list price to $15 and it costs you 10 per copy, then you can make a nice tidy $5 a copy through direct sales. Or maybe you're a famous blogger that has, you know, 500 people read your blog every day, and they're big fans, and they're willing to buy the book directly from you. Or there's lots of scenarios in which it can work out, but you have to have planned, you know, your marketing strategy that, you know, that X many sales are going to come from market Y, and so on.
There we go. Back to that self-marketing again. Yeah. I think it's going to be some repetition here over and over in each one of these, isn't there?
Well, I hope I'm not playing that string too hard.
It's so true. So we just covered subsidy. Now there's vanity presses and publishers. What is the difference?
Yeah, the vanity is basically a pejorative or a derogatory term, which is aimed at the subsidy presses. They would never call themselves vanity presses, but the fact is, you know, if you're paying them money to produce your book, it's somewhat of an act of vanity. The question is, you know, do you have the chutzpah to make it into a product that other people want?
Oh, but really, there isn't any difference. It's just a term that people use, like you say, a derogatory term.
Yeah, like, yeah. You know, so-and-so could only get their book published at a vanity press.
Uh-huh. And that's basically, it's paying somebody to publish your book.
Right. You know, some of these companies will object strenuously to it, so it's best not to say that, you know, Acme Publishing is actually a vanity press,
mm-hmm.
because their law department may contact you.
Okay, we'll just really steer away from that then. So,
yeah.
Basically, there are advantages and there are disadvantages to this. And so the author themselves would have to make the decision if this is going to work for them or not. And sometimes this may be the only way to get your name out there in the first place. Because it's
if you're in a really hurry and you have something that's coming up and you only have 3 weeks to get it done, you got to get it done, you know?
Exactly. Exactly. And like you had also mentioned that somebody that's on some type of a circuit or you know, sells books at the back of the room, this would be a way to go. It could be
a way.
Yeah,
exactly.
Mm-hmm. Sure. So also then, let's go to micro-publisher. What is a micro-publisher?
A micro-publisher is used to describe an independent publisher, which we sort of talked about earlier, who produces a smaller number of titles per year. The benchmark is, believe it or not, fewer than 25 titles per year. So I guess that makes me a micro-publisher, although I don't like to think of that myself that way. Or you can also say that a micro-publisher is someone with a certain revenue target that they meet every year. For example, Ingram Book Company, which is probably the world's number one distributor, defines a micro-publisher in their contracts as someone who generates under $15,000 in net sales over a two-year period. So net sales is, sales minus expenses.
Oh.
And other sources put that number at $20,000 over 2 years. And the 2007 Writer's Market, which is published by Writer's Digest, says that a micro-publisher is a company that publishes an average of fewer than 10 books a year. So let's just say 10 to 25 titles.
Mm-hmm. So I imagine micro and small, then a small publisher would sort of fit into the same category then.
Yeah, and they say, you know, small publisher would be the next tier up.
Oh, a tier up.
25 or more per year.
Ah.
Or with a smaller number of titles but bigger revenue than a micro publisher. Maybe, you know, they only produce 10 titles per year, but they have, you know, $50,000 a year net. They're both just different varieties of independent publishers. And, you know, you won't really necessarily see a micro or small publisher in anyone's mission statement or company description because, you know, companies grow and you don't necessarily end up at the place where you start.
Exactly. So you're saying that, 10, 25, that's the micro, small publishers. So how many books do the traditional publishers publish then per year?
Boy, I would say probably anywhere between 100 to 500 titles in a very large outfit. I don't have any specific statistics in mind, but that's sort of my gut feeling.
Mm-hmm. That makes about sense. We do reviewing for one of the major publishers, and that's probably about how many books we get per year from them. So you're probably right. Now, Victor, let's just go and talk a little more about the micro and the small publishers, the 10 to 25, maybe 30 books per year. What would be an advantage with being picked up by a publisher that size?
Well, that's a very good question, and the advantage is that you're not dealing with maybe eight different people who are handling your book. You're only dealing with perhaps one or two people at the company who are dealing with your book, and they all have the big picture in the sense that they understand your title, and you don't have to like keep re-explaining, you know, why your title's important and what your marketing angle is, because they'll have a better grasp because they handle fewer titles, they'll have more intimate knowledge of the book itself, and And I believe, you know, that they're in a better position to advocate for the book because their attention isn't split 100 different ways. It's, you know, just divided a small number of ways.
Mm-hmm. Sure. And it seems to me that would be more personable, too.
Yeah, you can actually, you know, I've developed myself some relationships with the authors that, you know, I'm confident in them, and whatever they want to write, I'm happy to represent, and they're happy to, you know, send it to me first, and it can really be quite a synergistic thing when you're able to, you know, not deal with a different person every time you call a company.
Exactly.
Because, you know, in the bigger companies, people move around, they're anxious to get promotions, or they get transferred around the country, and so on.
Exactly, and it's, like I say, it's more personable, and it's, you know, this is your baby, you've written this, you've birthed it, and you want somebody to really take care of it, and it seems to me, as what you're saying also, that it's more individual, like yourself, you build a relationship with the writer.
Exactly. It's a relationship, it's, you know, a commitment to customer service, a commitment to quality, and things like that that you can't really quantify in terms of numbers.
Exactly. So you've been listening to Authors Access, where authors get published and published authors get successful. Today's topic is understanding the publishing marketplace, and our special guest this hour is Victor Volkman, who's also my co-host at another show. I'm just so excited that he's talking to us and giving us all this information. And Authors Access, of course, is brought to you each week by Read Reviews and Loving Healing Press. And just for those of you that are in Chicago area, can meet Victor in person at the Midwest Psychological Association Conference in Chicago on May 3rd and 4th. So that's just next weekend.
And, yeah, it's going to be a busy week.
It sure is, my goodness.
So I'm actually going to be at the Mind, Body, Spirit show this Saturday, but I don't think our listeners will find out until too late.
Too late. Oh, that's too bad. But just keep us informed as to other places that you're going to be. So we'll... I'm sure that people will be happy to talk to you. Now, let's just kind of go back into our what we were talking about. And one of the things that I have seen written or heard about is co-publishing. What is a co-publisher?
Well, that's interesting because I had to do a little digging into that today to find out. And it turns out that some of the bigger selling books may actually farm out editions to different publishers. For example, take a look at one particular title by Stephen Covey. And you on Amazon, and you may see the names of two or three different publishers with different editions. Maybe you'll see one publisher published the book in 1988, and another published it and republished it in 1993, and so on. So different publishers may have a shot at different editions of a book. That's possible because depending on the way your contract's written, they may be able to sell off the publishing rights to another publisher. And the other possibility is some publishers may specialize in different formats. For example, trade paperback versus hardcover. You may have a different publisher who specializes maybe in getting self-help books out in paperback, and they will take on the publishing of that book in that particular format, whereas the other publisher maybe deals in hardcover editions, and that's where they are. That's where their sales are. Maybe they sell to libraries or something. And you can also end up with co-publishing in particular markets. So a different company may publish your book in the UK if you have the foreign rights sold off for that. We were talking to Stanley Greenfield about that last week.
Right. So basically, then, as the author really has nothing to do with a co-publisher, it's the original publisher probably gets somebody else to do, let's say, the hard copy or of the same book.
Right. At the closest you would ever get to it as an author would be maybe your agent is able to cut a deal for you because of his contacts or influences.
Mm-hmm. So the big one that's totally opposite from traditional publishing and any other publishing is the POD publisher. Give us an insight.
Well, that's kind of a tricky question. POD publishing is a name sometimes used by subsidy publishing to sort of cover their tracks and in a large sense has given print-on-demand a bad name. I mean, basically, you know, print-on-demand is a technology for delivering books in a just-in-time basis, just like the auto companies in the early 90s were able to capital costs considerably by making sure that, you know, parts arrived at the assembly line just in time to build a car. There's no reason that you have to have books gathering dust in the warehouse, when they're not, where no one can get at them. So that's the whole point of print on demand. But the term pod publisher has been sort of adopted by several of the subsidy publishers to sort of use another word other than subsidy or vanity to describe what they're doing. Which is, in the subsidy, there's some statistics that says in a subsidy press arrangement, typically they sell about 50 to 75 copies of a book and that's it. So given that you're never going to sell probably more than 100 in a subsidy press, you might as well use the cheapest technology to deliver that, which is, of course, print on demand.
Oh, okay. So basically then it's not the author or the writer themselves that go to is what we call a pod publisher, but it's basically, let's say, a subsidy then uses, or is the same thing, and they use the print-on-demand model.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
It's a more precise way of specifying subsidy publisher.
Uh-huh. Okay, well, this one now I'm going to ask you is a totally opposite of all the rest, and that's, of course, self-publishing.
Right. I mean, we could probably talk for hours about it, but I'll just give you the basic definition, and if you want to follow up, you can. Basically, it's to be self-published is a publisher who publishes only his or her own books, that's the first point, and does not publish the works of others. So it's typically, you know, just you, and that's point one. And to actually be a self-publisher, you must own the ISBNs, or International Standard Book Numbers, which are assigned to your books, even if it's only a block of, say, 10 numbers. Now, this is where some people get confused because, you know, they will go to a subsidy press, for example, get some books printed and say that, you know, I, you know, John Doe, am self-published. Well, that's not exactly true. If the ISBNs are, if you will, pointing to the subsidy press, then they are, in fact, the publisher. You are not the publisher, even though you may, you know, however loudly you may say so. The ownership in terms of who publishes book X is who owns the ISBN block.
Oh, so that's the difference.
Yeah.
Okay, that's making more sense now. I'm just, the question is now, would a person, let's say if I published my book, my only book, I created a name for my publishing company, I self-published it under a company name, so that would be called a self-publishing. Is that correct?
Right. And that presupposes that you went to ISBN.org, which in the U.S. is the official vendor, if you will, of ISBNs, and you purchased your ISBNs directly from them.
Okay.
Because unlike many things in the world, you cannot resell an ISBN. There is only, I mean, you can only buy it from ISBN.org, and they have blocks of 10, 100, 1,000, 10,000, 100,000. And if you really want, you can buy just one, but it's not a very economical way to go. Now, that brings me to a point that I forgot to mention in regards to a traditional publisher, which will always assign you an ISBN. There's, like, no charge for that. It's just a cost that the publisher absorbs of doing business. And there's a couple of other things that the traditional publisher will do, which is also make sure that your book is listed in the Library of Congress, which assigns it the colorful acronym of LCCN, Library of Congress Catalog Number. And the traditional publisher will also make sure that it's entered into the CIP program, or Cataloging in Publication. Now, that is a service provided through our tax dollars here in the U.S. that has the Library of Congress. Librarians will actually look at a manuscript before publication and figure out where it will be shelved, what are the salient categories of it, and each month, the Library of Congress publishes an electronic database, which is sent around the world to, you know, university libraries and other commercial subscribers that says, John Doe has just announced a book with this title, and this is the shelf number, and this is the category of books. So if you had, a library that specialized in, say, ophthalmology, you know, attached to a medical center, then if you wrote a book on ophthalmology, they could find out about it from the Library of Congress and get ready to place an order.
Okay. So, you know, after we've talked about all these different types of publishers and then, of course, there's self-publishing, what would be an advantage of being self-published?
Well, you are the captain of your own ship, they say. The buck stops there, really. If you want something done, you, by gosh, golly, you get it done. You can, you know, try and make the best deal on printing, you know, by submitting your bids to multiple printers so that you keep your costs contained. You decide, you know, when and where and how much time you're going to spend on marketing. You have, you know, complete artistic control, which can be a very bad thing, over the cover and the interior layout, because there are certain unwritten rules of book design, which, remember, we talked to Michelle DiFilippo of 1106 Design, that, you know, your average person is not a book designer. So the big issue that happens in self-publishing that you really have to think about all the time is the classic decision of make or buy. You know, do I do this particular task myself, or do I farm it out? And if I farm it out, how do I find someone that's going to give me the best deal and do a quality job? So there's a very much a management function with that. And the downside is, in self-publishing, that you are accepting 100% of the risk. That's part A. And part B is it never ends. You may never get to writing book number 2 or 3, or you may have a couple of years in between books because you're going to the post office and shipping books, or you're making phone calls and trying to get things done, and it can begin to dominate your creative life, if you know what I mean.
So basically, then, the person who does self-publish has to be really an organized person, know exactly what they're doing, and also, there again, as we talked, even with traditional publishers, doing their own marketing. And I would think that in self-publish, there might even be, you know, a step further in that. It would even be more so important because it is self-published, and unfortunately, there's still that stigma about self-published books. And so until we can get past that, which I'm glad it's kind of looking like it, we will eventually hear, there's still a lot of work.
Yeah, you're right. There is the stigma factor, too, which I tend to forget about, that, you know, you may have difficulty competing for pre-publication reviews with all the other publishers that, you know, I'm sure if something comes in to Publishers Weekly from Rand McNally, by God, it's going to get a review.
Yeah.
They're not going to snub it.
Yeah, exactly. You just mentioned a few minutes ago as you were talking, Victor, about printing. Let's just talk about some, let's say, offset printing.
All right, let's talk a little bit about offset printing. Without getting into the nuts and bolts of rollers, ink, and ink transfer, suffice it to say that offset printing is the mass production method of choice when you're looking at quantities of 1,000 to 10,000 books at a time. It used to involve the creation of metal plates that were used to stamp out pages, but now the computers burn films and so on. But it doesn't really matter how it's done, and you can look up, you know, Wikipedia if you're curious as to, you know, how many rollers you use and so on. But the important thing is that the setup charge is the major cost component, and that is the reason why it's never used for under 1,000 books. So if you're in the regime of under 1,000 books, you're definitely going to go with print-on-demand because that will be cheaper. When you hit a run of about 2,000 or more, and this is just a rule of thumb, you can save about 50% by using offset versus the cost of print on demand. Now, since we're in an industry where margins are often shaved down to literally $1 to $2 per book, we're talking about possibly a 50% increase in the per unit profit. So that seems like it's a really good thing. However, there are some hidden costs involved in offset printing, and I want to make sure that I hit all of these bullet points, so I'll just keep talking about this. The first thing to consider is that the setup time will probably be at least 4 weeks unless you happen to catch the printers in a not busy time of year. So your job will enter the queue, and they'll get to it when they darn well get to it. So that's the first thing to think about. The second thing to consider is that the size of the print run is everything. I'll say it again. The size of the print run is everything. If you print 3,000 but you only have a marketing ability to sell 2,000, you may reach break-even, and essentially you've made no money if you only ever manage to sell 2,000 out of a 3,000 print run. There's a famous aphorism that all the money on a book is lost in the last print run. In other words, you know, publishers will print a couple of print runs, and then the last one is one run too many. So you have to watch out for that phenomenon. Another thing to think about is that storage in a climate-controlled, bug-free, mildew-free, humidity-controlled condition is not cheap. And if you don't buy insurance, you could lose everything. I've heard a lot of horror stories over the last few years about book warehouses that were flooded, and you know, the warehouse, the wholesaler doesn't necessarily insure your stock, and I mean that could be a loss of thousands of dollars that you weren't planning on. In addition, even a lot of the bigger distributors will charge monthly rent. I've actually seen it, you know, X many dollars per pallet per month for your books to sit there and collect dust or whatever they do in a warehouse. I'm not really sure. Another point to consider is if you don't have a loading dock in your backyard, when the books are delivered, you may pay surcharges for a truck, which is essentially self-unloading. So shipping can be more expensive just due to the sheer quantity that arrives at your door. Now, shipping is an interesting problem with books. It seems that they're always in motion. With offset, the books are printed and are shipped at least twice, once from the printer to you, and once from you to the wholesaler, and then from the wholesaler to the retailer, and on and on and on, which is part of the reason why the discount levels are so extremely high in this business. However, with print-on-demand, what I find is more than half the orders that I process go directly from the factory to the retailer or the consumer, which ends up with a higher quality book because every time you handle it, you increase the scuffing and you get more damaged books. And so that's a thing to consider. And last but not least, God forbid you've made a mistake that could cost you $5,000 or more to ditch a whole print run. I've heard horror stories about someone who, when they were going to print their final copy, banged out a few keys on their keyboard, and page one had some unintelligible stuff in it. When they actually got their book, much to their horror, they had forgotten to look at that particular, you know, page on the proof, and they ended up ditching the whole print run. Now, if you use print on demand, you have the ability to sort of fix mistakes as you go, and that saved my bacon in my first book. I had made, in my haste, a couple of strategic errors that I was able to correct later, and frankly would have involved me dumping a lot of stock, too. It's easy to make a mistake on your first book. You know, 100,000 words or 70,000 words is a lot of words to keep track of.
Wow.
That is the short answer.
Well, this is a really good answer because as I'm listening to you here, and if the writers are wanting to are self-published, the print-on-demand is certainly the way to go instead of trying to do some offset printing and getting stuck with, and as you say, if there's an error, you're stuck with you know, it could be 950 books because you've only sold 50.
There's no undo there, is there?
Yeah.
Undo means a trip to the dump.
Exactly. Or, you know, do you want to donate them to somebody? But who, you don't want to donate books that have a flaw in them. So certainly the print on demand is the way to go.
Right. And someday if you decide that you really can't sell any more of your thousands of books, you will sell them to a remainder house who will give you maybe maybe 30 or 40% of what it cost you to print them. So there is no recovering the cost of unsold books, really.
I've been to remainder outlets where you can buy a book that originally was $30 for a dollar.
Yeah. Right, and you should understand that the author is getting none of that money.
Exactly.
You buy the $1 coffee table book.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Right. Beautiful books that, you know, cost a lot of money to print originally, and of course all the heart and soul that went into making it. Now, let's just talk a little about book packagers and book manufacturers.
Right. Let's start off with book packagers. I have an interesting article that I read about book packaging by Jenna Glatzer, and if anyone's interested, they can email me and I'll send them the link. But the basic idea is that book packagers, which are also known as book producers, act as liaisons between publishing houses and everyone who works to put together a book, which is to say the authors, the artists, the editors, photographers, researchers, indexers, and even the printers. The fact is that publishing houses often don't have enough in-house resources to do as many titles as they'd like to. So basically your book packager is sort of outsourcing the development to a third party. So these people, in addition to assembling the other components necessary for a finished book, may be responsible for locating an author to write a manuscript. Now, the most common occurrence of a book packager is in a series. You may be shocked to know that the Nancy Drew series, Sweet Valley High, Goosebumps, and many of the Complete Idiots guides, and even the Four Dummies are merely packaged books. So there's a book packager who's out there, and he knows that, you know, he's got 12 different Four Dummies books to come out this year, and he's going to locate the authors, and he's going to be kind of pulling the strings behind the scenes. The sort of inventor of book packaging was a fellow named Edward Stratemeyer, and he founded his company, Stratemeyer Associates, originally came out with the Bobbsey Twins, the Hardy Boys, and Nancy Drew, all of which were written by ghostwriters. He would give them the plot outline, pay them a flat fee, and he had just a series of pseudonyms just so that, you know, the sheer volume of books coming out would be unrealistic for any one person. So he just basically had, you know, a set of pseudonyms going on for that. But big and small publishers all use packagers. Simon & Schuster, Viking, HarperCollins, Macmillan, Dell, Bantam, all the big names, Reader's Digest books. Now, to tell whether a book was produced by a packager, there'll probably be a note on the copyright page, you know, just giving a credit to the packager. So this sounds like a great thing. Authors, if you're an author who has done work that appeared in magazines, literary journals, and newspapers, there may be a book packager out there who wants to work with you. So that's a big advantage of working in the magazine business. When I was, at one time I had 4 monthly computer columns going every month, and that was crazy. But it gave me a lot of street cred, and when the publisher of our magazine also had a small line of books, basically all I had to say is, look, I want to write this book, and they knew me, and I was a known quantity. The pathway was very smooth. So that's a thing to think about for you people that have a book idea. Getting a syndicated column is a much simpler thing to do, and it can give you a lot of credibility when it comes time to pitch your book. Now, the downside from the author's point of view, working with a packager, is there's not a royalty package. Basically, you present you with a contract for a flat rate for X thousand words, and then your name will not appear on the book under most circumstances with a book packager. If it's part of a series, you know, for example, maybe you're writing for Time Life Books or something, But it's essentially a work-for-hire deal, which means the publisher owns all the rights and you don't have reprint rights. And if it's a fiction book and it's optioned for a movie, you will probably not get a piece of that. So that's some of the basics of book packaging.
Wow. You know, as I'm listening to you here, this is a really complicated world. And what it sounds like to me, unless you have somebody who is like John Grisham, who actually incidentally started as a self-published author selling books out of the back of his, out of the trunk of his car, and look at now, you know, where he is. I mean, there's a few of those that actually are success stories. This is a complicated world.
It's constantly evolving, too. We find that over the last few years, the wholesalers have been creeping into the distributor market as they offer more and more services. It used to be, for example, the wholesaler was literally, you know, a place that kept your book in a warehouse hoping that the phone would ring and someone would order the book. But now they're sort of getting into selling marketing packages, and they're looking at, you know, at developing product lines along a particular line of business. And so the line is really getting blurry between the wholesalers and distributors.
Wow. Well, gosh, Victor, look what time it is. I just can't believe
that.
You know, you've given us so much information. It's all mind-boggling, but yet there's so much clarity, and I really do appreciate it. Victor, just tell our listening audience your website address, please.
Sure, with pleasure. The main website for our publishing house is lovinghealing.com, and we do self-help, psychology, books on disabilities, and we do have a small line of New Age books, and we do accept the unsolicited submissions. There's complete writer's guidelines on our site. We're booked for 2007, but you never know.
Well, you know, 2008 isn't that far, and basically if this is the time to start really thinking about books for 2008, because there's all the pre-marketing that the authors have to do. You don't do the marketing after the book is published. You do a lot of it before. And so 2008 is actually a good time to have your book published.
Exactly. This is the time in the next 3 months to really get your proposal in order, to find out what your competition is, to discover, you know, what publishers are in your genre, find out, you know, publishers that have published a book just like yours, and odds are they may go for it. So don't think that, you know, just because they already have, you know, 10 books out on Oriental cooking that they won't want book number 11. Maybe they will.
Exactly. Gosh, you've been listening to another podcast edition of Authors Access, where authors get published and published authors get successful. You can hear us every Thursday at 8 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. We'll be back on the air on Thursday, April 26th, and our topic will be Internet Marketing and eBooks. And our special guest who will be joining us is Ken McLean of the Big Picture Press. You can learn more about our guests on the Authors Access website, which is authorsaccess.com. Authors Access is a joint production of Reader Views and Loving Healing Press. And for Reader Views, this is Irene Watson of Austin, Texas, signing off.